Oh, hello again, everyone. So our next talk, second here at DMF 2016 on stage A, is Sophie Scott. Is that right?
Yes.
Good. Talking about science of laughter. With no further ado, I'll hand over.
Right. Thank you very much. Thank you. So I'm going to talk to you this afternoon about the science of laughter, and I'd like to try and start by initially convincing you that there is such a thing as a science of laughter. I mean, if you go onto any of the mainline databases for looking at published papers and put in the terms emotion, expression and fear, if you go to PubMed, for example, put in those terms, you'll get back well over 1,000 papers. And if you just replace the word fear with laughter, emotion, expression and laughter, you get back 45 papers, and about 4 of those are by me. So it's not like there's an enormous field of research, but I'm going to try and convince you that it is worth looking at. The other thing that I just want to establish at the start is how deeply weird laughter is. It's a really peculiar behaviour. I'm going to play you some recordings of real human beings laughing. And I want you just to think about as a primate sound. Imagine I was an explorer coming back from the rainforest and saying, I found this new type of ape and this is the vocalisation it produces. You wouldn't be surprised if it was something like this. So there's adult male laughter, sounds kind of recognisable. Okay, things get a little stranger now. This guy I find a bit distressing because I need him. I badly need him to take a breath. It sounds like he's going to pass out. About here. I need a breath about here. It turns out most people laugh when they're breathing out, ha ha ha, so it's just exhalation. He's also breathing in while laughing, so he's going ha, as well. So it sounds like he's going to die, but in fact it's okay, air's getting into him, and I'll come back to that. And finally, this is a human female. She says, my God, what is that in French?
Oh mon Dieu, c'est quoi ça?
So it's a very peculiar sound, and sometimes I think when we're laughing really helplessly, genuinely in an involuntary way, it can take you into places where you make sounds you would never make, sort of voluntarily. All other things being equal, I bet that woman was preferred that she hadn't started going, you know, on a recording of some kind. And part of that is because it's an involuntary vocalisation, and part of it is because of some of the weird stuff that happens when we laugh. And to think about what laughter is, you need to think about a part of the body that people that work in neurosciences don't normally pay much attention to. You've got to think about the rib cage. Generally, in psychology and neurosciences, we concern ourselves with the head and the stuff that's sort of inside the head. And then if you're really Freudian, you might go straight down to the pants and the stuff around there. But most of the rest of the body, we don't pay much attention to. But actually, the rib cage is amazing. And what you're all doing at the moment is using your rib cage, the ribs, the muscles between the ribs, and the diaphragm along the bottom to stay alive. So what you're doing is you're getting air in and out of your lungs using your rib cage. So you use the intercostal muscles, the muscles between your ribs, to pull your rib cage out and up. That creates negative pressure and draws air into the lungs. You relax them back down, and that squeezes the air out. So you just get this sort of cyclical motion. You did it from the minute you were born, whole rest of your life, don't stop. Okay, you're all doing it right now. Now, that gives you, if I was to measure this by looking at your movement of your ribs, just by putting a breath belt around the outside of your chest, you get this sort of smooth sinusoidal movement. As soon as we start talking, we use these same muscles, the intercostal muscles and the diaphragm, completely differently. And what we do is we take a breath in, and then we use those same intercostal muscles to maintain a constant flow of air at a particular pressure at the larynx, the voice box. And if I keep talking without taking another breath, you'll start to hear that I lose my voice because my intercostal muscles are diaphragm and slot where it really, really hard to squeeze the air out. And one of these days, at the end of doing that, I'm either going to pass out or urinate. And I think we're okay. And so You're probably thinking, well, that was interesting, Sophie, and a bit weird. No, essentially, that's the only reason we can talk at all is because we can do this. We can only do this at all because we walk upright. In our evolution, we've gone up into our back legs. All other mammals, all other quadrupeds, have to use their forelimbs to support their weight. And this means they're using their intercostal muscles to help support their structure. What's happened in our evolution is we've gone up onto our back legs. We have, along with very different muscular control of our orofacial region, got a completely different muscular control over the rib cage and these muscles and the diaphragm in between the ribs. This means that we are the only animal that can do this. We're the only animal that can breathe this way. And that means it's one of the main reasons why we are one of the only animals that talk. This is giving us continuous speech. We don't have to say words on each exhalation. So you've got this kind of long, continuous span of speech. It's putting all the rhythm and the music into speech. It's an amazing thing. We tend not to pay attention to it. And it has a complete enemy. When you start laughing, you start to get a very different pattern. When you start laughing, these same muscles, the muscles between your ribcage and your diaphragm, start to do huge contractions. This is me laughing. You get these very, very rapid deflections. It's just squeezing air out of you. And we don't really understand why, but when you start laughing involuntarily, it will stop you from talking and it will stop you from breathing. And for most people, it's just squeezing air out of you and it is trying to kill you. It's quite dangerous, but a stressful thing, laughter. So just to look at this from a different perspective, this is running an MRI machine, like a video camera, to show what happens when somebody's talking. So this is a colleague of mine speaking. And you can see here all these amazingly fine movements that she's making with her tongue and her lips and her soft palate. And all of us are able to do this amazingly precise movement. And that's what gives us human speech. We're the only animal that can do all this with our articulators and our tongue. As soon as we start laughing, none of that happens. Remember, all this stuff's going on down at the rib cage and then up at the mouth, everything's just flat. So this is somebody laughing in the scanner. And the tongue's just sitting at the bottom of the mouth. And the mouth's just open. Nothing complicated is happening at all. It's an unbelievably primitive way of making a sound. You notice how this space here is narrowing up. If you've ever laughed until your throat's hurt, that's why. The pharynx kind of constricts. What this means in practice is that when you laugh, you're forcing out more air than you normally force out, and if you're forcing out through a narrower pipe, that means that you can start to get really high-pitched noises. I've got a really high-pitched laugh. I can never take my voice up there to sing deliberately. Now we've got the first thing that happens when someone's talking and they start laughing, often therefore, is actually a disruption of the pitch of their voice because it's their breath control that they're losing. So I've got an example here of somebody trying to do a radio broadcast when she hears something that she finds amusing. I'm just going to play it. The pitch of the voice is shown down here in blue.
Singer Rock's unpopular replacement has now been dismissed, with the Army's popular Chief of Staff, Jack Twatt, taking over.
A 40-foot sperm whale, which was stranded in the Firth of Forth for more than 4 days, is now thought to be swimming towards open waters again. It freed itself late last night. Marine experts are hoping to establish this morning whether the whale is finally back at sea.
Good luck to the whale. 8:10 is the time. An investigation is underway at the maze.
Now, if you work with human voices, there's a lot to love about this recording. I really like the way the guy coming down the line has got to say a silly name. He's got to say Jack Twatt, and he just goes for it. Nothing to see here. Popular Chief of Staff, Jack Twatt. And there we go, out there. And if you listen very, very carefully, back in the studio, somebody leans into Charlotte Green, because she's the broadcaster, and they go, Jack Twatt, right at her. And they're doing that for one reason and one reason only. They're trying to make her laugh. And it works. So she starts talking about the whale, and she's doing okay, and then you start to see her systematically losing control of the pitch of her voice. And then, towards the end, the pitch of her voice shoots right up, and by the end of the utterance, she continues making noises after she stopped talking. This is a woman who is paid on the radio to talk. She'll get in trouble for this. She knows she'll get in trouble for this. She can't stop doing it, and she's making these funny noises at the end, because by that stage, she is now laughing. and she can't do anything about it. So you sort of see this evolution from a loss of pitch control through to actually over laughing. Now, one of the things that we found in the human brain is that the human brain really, really likes laughter. It's an extremely alerting and sort of directive sound. You're always trying to work out why people are laughing. We noticed this a few years ago when we played people laughter in the scanner, and we noticed, like we were playing other emotional noises, we weren't particularly interested in laughter at the time. We were using it because it's very, very positive. People rate it as very positive, and we were comparing it to very negative sounds like screaming sounds and disgusted sounds. And what we noticed was we got what looked like quite a strong contagion effect when people heard laughter. It looked like people were getting ready to move their faces and use their voices when they heard laughter. And when we read about it, and of course, laughter is unbelievably behaviourally contagious. Not only emotionally contagious, because that's the job of emotions and that's what we were looking at, laughter, along with a few other human behaviours, is extremely behaviourally contagious. If you can very frequently find yourself laughing, even if you've got no idea why other people are laughing, and you're much more likely to do that with somebody you know than someone you don't know. Now, there's nothing peculiar about laughter in this respect. There's quite a lot of behaviours we do that have this characteristic. So yawning works this way. You can catch a yawn from somebody else, and you're much more likely to catch a yawn from someone you know than someone you don't know. I used to use a picture of my son to make this point about yawning, and somebody pointed out, do you notice you always yawn after you've shown the photograph? Nobody else yawns, they don't know who it is. I haven't said who it is, but I start yawning. Actually, weirdly, and there's probably a whole other talk in this, there is a lot of other contagious behaviour that we're going for, including blinking. Blinking is contagious. Try that one out with your friends when you get out of here. But there's a lot of human behaviour that we do that we're sort of picking up from other people to show affiliation and friendship. And of course, that's one of the key features of laughter. If you ask people about laughter, if you ask them why they laugh, they will talk about jokes and humour and comedy. If you look at them and you look at when they laugh when they're with other people. It's a completely social behaviour. So you're 30 times more likely to laugh if there is somebody else with you than if you're on your own. And you will laugh more if you like those people, you know those people, you want them to like you. So it's got this enormously social aspect. What this means in practice is that where we laugh most is when we're talking to other people, because that's what we do when we're with other people. And that, even within those conversations, if you really look at them, what you find is people still are not laughing at jokes. They're laughing at statements like, I might miss the bus, or I'm going to get a cup of coffee. And in fact, at any one time, the person who laughs most is the person who's talking. It's part of their communicative act. Now, that's quite interesting, because that suggests that some laughter that you're encountering, this social laughter, isn't helpless, involuntary laughter like I was playing you at the start. A lot of social laughter seems to be quite communicative. You're choosing at some level to produce it. So we started looking more at this. And to do this, what we did was we got people into our anechoic chamber, and we did whatever we could to make them laugh. Short of tickling each other, we literally, whatever it took. So, for example, to make me laugh, I just have to have a friend of mine, and I can see her, and she's listening to something really rude that I know makes her want to start laughing, and that will make me start laughing. I just watch stuff on my own. I sit there and don't laugh. Whatever it takes. Somebody else had to watch an entire episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. They specified the episode. They specified who had to be sitting next to them. And they said, this is when I will laugh, and they did laugh, and that's great, we've got this lovely laughter. And then we got those same people to produce laughs, and we said, imagine your friends told a joke and you're laughing because you like your friend, not because, you know, you're not laughing helplessly. We certainly didn't want kind of ha, ha, ha laughter. So I've got some of those, I'm just going to play you. So does this laugh sound like it's a helpless, involuntary laughter, or do you think it's a real laugh? Real or posed? Real. It's me. I'm the best. It's very high-pitched. Now, how about this one? Real or posed? Now, interestingly, we did an acoustic analysis of these. You're right, that is posed. Now, the real laughs, they're longer, they're higher in pitch because of all this pressure that you're generating when you're laughing helplessly. Interestingly, the posed laughs, they're not just weak versions of real laughs. They've got their own thing going on. So that laugh I just played you is really nasal. quality to it. And in fact, that is very common in the UK for social laughter. We're actually marking our laughter. You couldn't do that with your soft palate, with your nose, when you're laughing helplessly. We're showing people, I'm giving you this laughter. It's a really important sign. And this, again, the brain cares about it. So in this study, we took the different sorts of laughs. We didn't tell people it was a study on laughter. We didn't tell them anything about what was going on. Then we just put them in the scanner, played them lots of sounds. Some of them were laughs, some of them were real, some of them were posed. And then afterwards, we looked to see what the results were. And what we found was that although we did not tell people it was a laughter study and we didn't tell them there was real and posed laughter in there, the brain cares. And what you get, the regions in blue, in auditory parts of the brain, respond much more strongly to the real laughs, probably because you hear unambiguously these sounds you never hear in any other context when somebody's laughing helplessly. In contrast, these regions in pink, very extensive areas of the brain, care about the posed laughter. And these are areas of the brain that you would see activated if somebody was making decisions about what they think somebody else is thinking. They're so-called mentalizing areas. Now, people weren't doing anything here, they're just listening. When you hear somebody clearly faking a laugh, you are trying to work out why. There's a reason why that person's doing that. Maybe they're embarrassed, maybe they're in pain, maybe they're angry, maybe they're trying to get someone to like them. All these things we use laughter for, you're trying to work out why, because it's an immensely important signal, even if you don't necessarily think it's got anything to do with you. And very, very briefly, we've been looking at this in terms of behavioural changes in with age. So if you've taken this real and posed laughter, and this is age of people down here, and we've got hundreds of participants, and what you see is that the older you get, the more real the real laughter sounds. And in fact, somewhat more slowly, it takes you longer to work out about the posed laughter. And in fact, people's behaviour does not start to get perfect with recognising posed laughter of what it is until they're in their late 30s. So it's not sorted out by the time you hit puberty. It's not sorted out by the time your brain is fully matured at the end of your teens. You are learning about what laughter means throughout your entire early adult life, and that's probably because the only place you can learn about it is back in these social interactions. You do not stop learning about this. Now, I've kind of described laughter as an important behaviour, and I just want to end on a point that suggests it may be even more important than that. So I've kind of stressed its social role, and it's something we do when we're with other people. When we're with other people, we're laughing to show them that we like them. We might even love them. We agree with them, we understand them, we are part of the same group as them. You're doing all this affiliative work with your laughter, but it may be even more important than that. There's really nice work coming out of the US from Robert Levinson's lab, where he does work with couples, and he gets couples over many years. This is a prospective study, it's been running for decades. They get them into the lab, they wire them up to a polygraph. It's very heteronormative, they're always a man and a woman. And he sits them down, and they're all wired up so you can see how their blood pressure's going and how their pulse is going and how much they're sweating. And he says to one of them, he deliberately gives them a stressful question, he says to one of them, tell me something your husband does that irritates you. And just run that one through your head. Think about in front of your closest loved one saying to them, to their face, something they do that irritates you. What he finds is that couples who deal with that, with what he calls positive affect, but he means laughter, not only immediately become less stressed, you see them getting on top of the stress, they feel better, and they only works if they do it together. If one person's going, ha ha, you know, it is very funny, and the first person's going, no, it's a massive problem. No one feels better. So only if they both laugh do you see this reduction in stress. But also, on longer time scale, they are the couples who are happier in their relationship, and they are the couples who stay together for longer. So laughter isn't just a sign that we're using socially to indicate that we know people and we like people. With people that we've got strong emotional connections to, and I suspect that this is not going to be only true of romantic relationships, it's actually one of the ways that we manage emotionally difficult situations, and we regulate our emotions together, and it only works if you all do it together. Now, Robert Levinson has some really beautiful films of elderly couples making each other laugh, and it really warms your heart. I don't have that. I've got a video I nicked from YouTube of some young men in the former East Germany making a film about their heavy metal band. Now, I've edited out considerable amount of swearing, which is in English, but what I want you to notice is how the emotional tone changes when something goes wrong, and something does go wrong. So it starts out with a lot of bravado, certain amount of nudity. He's expecting to get cold and he's expecting to get wet.
Müssen wir eine Rede halten?
It's clearly, he's got his towel, he's got his swimming trunks on.
Ich ziehe mich da gleich sofort raus.
Ich fülle das Wasser
mit Eis.
Eis hier überall.
Sogar überall rein.
He's got looks quite apprehensive. Yeah. When he starts swearing, there's quite a lot of bicep kissing, quite a lot of machismo.
Yeah.
We're off.
Oh. And my new band is called Syskill.
Now, his friends are already laughing. They're laughing really hard, and he's not laughing yet. They're absolutely howling. And he starts going around now. I've actually collapsed.
Hey, Alter!
Now, I'm lucky enough to have a job where people frequently send me YouTube videos and say, look at the laughter on this. And I've been sent this one several times by people saying, it's a great example of sort of schadenfreude. We're laughing because something goes wrong. But it is much more complex than that, because the mood beforehand is serious. And then when what they all expect to happen, he's going to go through the ice, he's going to get cold and wet. When that doesn't happen, but also there's not blood and bone everywhere, his friends start laughing. It takes a couple of beats, and then he starts laughing too. And that's actually how they're managing what could be a painful, embarrassing, you might be cross, you might be embarrassed, or sort, you know, stop filming me, what's going on? All of that could be going on. And if you just imagine the situation, if he was lying there with a visibly broken leg, and his friends were laughing like that, and he was going, please, please take me to the hospital, it would be awful. We would not enjoy watching it. Similarly, if he was running around with a visibly broken leg going, this is just hilarious, and his friends were going, Henrik, I'm not being funny, you've got to come back. Again, we wouldn't be laughing. One of the things we enjoy about this is actually seeing people using laughter to regulate those emotions. So that's the same thing I suspect that Robert Levinson's looking at, but just with friends. In fact, I suspect that might be what we mean by friendship, people with whom we can use laughter in that way. So I think scientifically, it's time to start taking laughter much more seriously. Thank you.
We've got time for a couple of questions. I've got one, actually, to begin with.
Yep.
Have you done much research into why we laugh?
Much less research. So there is a lot of research into humour, and I think that's a very interesting field of research, but I think one of the problems with it is most of the time when we laugh out in the wild, we're not laughing at humour. So humour is very interesting. This seems to be much more of a social emotion than we normally give it credit for. And you only really find that out if you go and look at people. So if you ask people, they'll say, I laugh at jokes and humour. But actually, you laugh most of the time when you're with other people. And you're laughing as much because you like them and how you feel about them as it is because of anything they've actually done.
OK. Does anyone else? Oh, yep. Run to the back.
So I don't know if I missed this because I was slightly late. What are other species? Do other species laugh in a human-like way?
Very good question. I didn't mention this. So if you look, you find laughter in the other great apes. So it looks and it sounds very much like laughter. Gorillas laugh, orangutans laugh, chimpanzees laugh. If you look more generally, and the problem is people aren't really doing this, but for example, Yank Panksepp, who has done lots of work with rats in the US, has found that they laugh as well. They make a particular vocal behaviour when they're playing with each other, and they make the same behaviour if they're being tickled. And if you tickle them every day, they make the sound when they see you come into the lab, so it's actually sort of anticipatory. And you can encourage laughter in rats, so the more that you tickle a baby rat, the more it will laugh when it's as an older rat. So it does seem to, it doesn't sound like laughter, but it's situationally extremely similar. So like with humans and orangutans and rats, you first see laughter emerge when babies have an interaction with their caregivers. Often it's tickling. With humans, and this is maybe something that's specific to humans, it can also be peekaboo. So maybe one of the things about different humans is we don't necessarily have to have the physical contact, but the grounding in other mammals is still there between infants and caregivers, and that seems to be where you first see laughter appearing. And it seems to argue for laughter, certainly when it first emerges, as being a social bonding mechanism.
Do any of these other animals laugh in the way that you showed there of responding to events?
Or is it
purely social?
There's some evidence from chimpanzees that chimpanzees have two different sorts of laughs. They laugh differently if they're being tickled than if they're trying to make play last longer. That sounds a lot like our social laughter and our involuntary laughter, with the involuntary laughter being like tickling and the play laughter being like conversational laughter. So I think it's at least possible that you're seeing that voluntary-involuntary distinction in chimpanzees, and we'd need to know more work with other primates to know if that kind of carried over into other primates who live in intensely social groups.
Hi, I was wondering whether there's also some research about what it does to us in the long-term sense. I mean, it obviously makes us kind of happy, but I'm thinking about, for example, this laughter yoga thing where people on purpose laugh with each other.
It is definitely it feels good to laugh. You feel better when you've been laughing, and there are definite physiological changes that go with that. So you get an increase in the body's, in the circulation of the body's natural, an increase in the uptake of the naturally circulating endorphins when you've been laughing, and that gives you a measurable change in pain thresholds. Anybody here laugh when they're in pain? I tend to find a handful of people. That's probably what you're actually doing, is you're accessing a natural form of pain relief. However, that's not specific to laughter. That's actually associated with your body doing some work, and you do quite a lot of work at your ribcage when you're laughing. It's about equivalent to eating an apple for every 15 minutes of laughter, so it's not that much work, but it's probably enough to give you an endorphin kick. You also, and this does seem to be more specific to laughter, get a decrease in adrenaline, and over a longer time course, a decrease in cortisol. And cortisol, well, adrenaline's a fight or flight hormone, and a reduction in adrenaline is seen when you feel more relaxed. You are not feeling stressed. You're not feeling like you've got to run. And cortisol is a slower acting, longer timescale hormone, which is strongly associated with stress. It's the hormone that wakes you up in the morning. It's the hormone that is at high levels if you are really stressed out. And that goes down when you've been laughing. So I think what we don't know is what the contribution is of the social elements of laughter from that, because that's where you find laughter, or the actual act of laughing. But there's definitely quite good scientific evidence that there are reasons why you are feeling better when you've been laughing.
Hi, I'm curious about, you're talking about laughter with people that you like, but I'm wondering if you've done much research about people going to, say, comedy gigs where there's just lots of people surrounding and you feel like you ought to laugh because everyone else is.
We have tried looking at audiences, and I haven't given up hope on this. One of the things we found in our studies is that if you take comedy audiences and you shine bright lights on everybody's faces and you make them wear breath belts and you put on motion capture devices and you film them, they stop laughing. It's very, very quick. And they just sit there going, oh, Christ, what's going on? And the comedian has a horrible time and no one likes you. So it is very, very interesting because one of the things I'm interested in is what happens when you get a group of people becoming an audience. If you look at how you go to a comedy gig, there'll be an MC who comes out first. So one of the first things they'll do is say, good evening, Penge. Who's your first time at Comedy Club for Kids in Penge? And you get them to get the audience to start making a noise. Even before you're laughing, they try and get you to behave together, and they're trying to do all this stuff to get you up and going, get you laughing. And laughter begets laughter. Remember, it's hugely contagious. So when you've got people laughing, the chances are that it will be easy to keep them laughing, and they're trying to keep the energy up between all the acts. But I'm really interested in detail within that. How much is a stand-up comedy act like the kind of conversational laughter that I talked about, where it's just a weird conversation where one person does all the talking? So a lot of the kind of skill in comedy is, and obviously what you say has got to be funny, but it's a very new skill. And what you used to find, people would do a kind of da-da-da-da-da punchline, ba-dum-tish, and the audience would get a cue to laugh. And nowadays, people don't go ba-dum-tish. But you will see people go, and that was why I never go to... and I can't think of a word. That's why I never go to Blackburn. And they'll take a drink, or they'll take a step forward, or they'll do a little smile. They do all sorts of little stuff. Like Louis C.K. does a massive number of little shows. Fine, I've just said something really inappropriate, but you can laugh to this. And that kind of cue and entrainment I'm really interested in, because are they, you know, at one level we think of stand-up comedy as being a verbal skill, and it is a verbal skill, but how much are they also kind of entraining the audience? Much as we know people kind of laugh together in conversations, are they kind of repurposing that in a comedy environment? So one day I will find a comedian who is so popular with his or her audience that the audience won't care that I'm filming them all and I'm measuring them all, and they'll just be enjoying it, and hopefully I'll get an answer for you.
Thanks. I have to ask one on the way. What's your favourite joke?
My favourite joke? I do really like what's round and sounds like a trumpet. A crumpet. I'm not very sophisticated.
Hi. Very interesting. I'm interested really in the evolution of the action. You know, it seemed to me very basic compared to talking.
Yes.
Does that mean that it comes from, you know, the basic noises that the apes make?
Yes.
Is that its
evolution? Exactly.
So
the reason I started looking at laughter was because I was looking at these non-verbal emotional vocalizations, things like, you know, you're howling in grief, or you're making ugh sound, or you're screaming because you're scared. When those really involuntary sounds are actually part of an older evolutionary pathway that's got much more in common with how all mammals vocalize. And actually the sounds themselves are not like speech. They're primarily to do with moving your ribcage and making a sound at the larynx. You don't do much up here. And that was why I was looking at laughter at all. I wasn't looking at laughter, hadn't really even thought about it as a thing on its own. I was just looking at it as a positive kind of these examples. So one of the best sources of evidence of this is people... So humans have got this old evolutionary pathway, like all other mammals. We've also evolved what's called these lateral motor areas, which are here, and we use them for talking, and they're specific to us, and they do all that motor control for speaking. If you have damage to those systems, for example, following a stroke, you can be left with a very profound aphasia. You can't speak anymore, but you can still laugh, you can still cry, you can still do all these older, evolutionarily older vocal behaviours. So it does seem to be part of a different pathway, and as you say, exactly, it is older.
That perhaps explains why you get so much brain activity.
Because
it perhaps helps explain why there's so much brain activity when you're hearing somebody laughing.
Yes.
Old communication.
Yes.
I think that's it for time and questions. Thank you very much indeed, Sophie Scott.
Thank you.
For
Thank you.
Things about Martha.